Is it like 1 in the morning?
Right, right, right.
Because we have like
almost
400 episodes.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. I'm all
there. Doing it like 10 years.
Yeah. And we've been doing ours about 10 years.
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of interesting that we're like in the same.
Yeah. Got into cable around the same time.
Same time, yeah.
I just A S asked.
Yeah.
For a 2.5 hour time slot. Because they didn't have that as an option.
Yeah.
So he said, I'd like to do 2.5 hours. And they said, okay. But I think in Berkeley, they don't have a lot of people that are doing shows. It's not like very competitive.
In New York, it's really, everything's a half hour.
Yeah.
You know, maybe sometimes you could do an hour special, you know.
Yeah.
But I love it.
How do you F I fit L I life into a half hour?
Yeah, exactly. Totally bullshit. But was really one of the things that was the most fucking interesting thing was when I went to get that piece of pizza, but I had the books, right? So I'm waiting for the pizza. And I started to read the NYU lecture, you know, and I'm a fast reader. I'm the highest comprehensive reader when I was 12 years old in my age group in the state of Connecticut. So I'm like reading, right? And then my eyes fell on this whole, I mean, you and I have to talk, of course, a lot about the commodification of art, right? And I was like talking with the boys about I'm like totally a emerging arts fighter. I hate the whole concept of emerging arts. It drives me insane. You know, it's
you if a art is not emerging, it is not art.
Yeah, but there's a big difference between suddenly saying after 1,000 years where there were young artists who became old artists, and now they have this the idea of emerging arts as a class of young people.
Yes.
This comes not from the art world. This comes from academia, because parents who are paying $250,000 to educate their kids to be a performance artist or a spoken word artist or an experimental filmmaker, it's the same amount of money that it costs to educate somebody to be a lawyer or a surgeon. The parents want to be assured that there is an entry-level position for their kids. And this is terrible for young people, because young artists, there's no two ways. Jack Smith said, you have to apprentice. It's the only way to learn how to make art, you know. And not that people shouldn't also do their own thing, you know.
J, just do
art.
Just do it.
Yeah, just do it. Absolutely.
For,
well, the famous.
Why? Or just do it for years.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But you have to be willing to be bad for 20 years in order to be good, you know?
Yes.
And I was talking with the boys, and I was like saying that, you know, what they've been doing with this emerging arts thing is creating this professionalization of art. And art is not a profession. Mm-hmm. Art is a vocation. When I was reading in your
Art of a Shaman.
Art of a Shaman, and I was reading this part where you were talking about, you know, what they did with performance into making it into a certain amount of time. Like many, many people said about my show, because, you know, I invite anybody, right? And I didn't know it was going to be so long. You know, I didn't know it was going to be so long. And that's not one of my long shows, you know.
E, X, exactly.
Yeah.
In, they think that 4, 48, the 4, 45 minutes
right.
is a long show.
Right, right.
And I do 48 hour
yeah.
performances.
Yeah, of course. But it's because you're a master. You're a master. Yeah. But it was very empowering for me because I was very, very tired. I was very sick the whole week from the first night you came to the Thursday night you came. I was sick that whole week with very bad bronchitis. And I had hepatitis C a few years ago, and I went on the interferon treatment. And then I got an autoimmune illness called sarcoidosis that settled in my lungs. So it made me weak in my lungs. So when I get bronchitis, which I seem to get now every time I get a cold, I had no energy. Mm-hmm. So all those shows I was doing with no energy, which is very hard, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I was worried about the length. Do you know what I mean? Myself, I was like going, fuck, you know, like I don't have that, like the energy to like, you know, usually the opening of the show when I introduce the dancers, that's like an assault, you know.
Yeah. Q, like, A, W, R, E, S, wrestling, A, announcer.
Like like a wrestling announcer, exactly. It's a very dynamic fighting, very aggressive, you know. Yeah. And I didn't have quite that much energy. Do you know what I mean? So I was like pushing it uphill all the way. It was very hard for me. So that night when I went to get the pizza and then you gave me the book, I was like looking at it. And then I read that thing about, what they've done with performance. Because, you know, I think you and I are in agreement about a lot of things. For instance, I always say that performance only happens in the performance, right? It doesn't happen. You don't rehearse performance art. You know what I mean? That's kind of, you know.
Or rehearsal is a
performance. Right, performance, absolutely. Right. Yeah, perfect. Right, no problem. So then when I was reading it and I fell on these lines where you were talking about how they've taken, you know, performance and tried to fit it into this kind of entertainment category, etc. And then if you don't do that, then you're like sloppy or you're bad or you're, you know, unprofessional or whatever. And you know, and my eyes fell on that, and then I was like, oh my God, like, I was just getting seduced down this road, you know, getting twisted up, you know, and feeling bad about myself, you know. And then the other thing was also, of course, the most exciting thing that I read at that moment was about how the show goes where the show's going to go. The performance goes where the performance is going to go.
You don't see control it. You don't control
no,
it.
No. It has to go where it's going to go. And the thing, like all my work is created improvisationally. Then this show is the result of pretty much 2 years of straight improvisation. And then eventually it becomes kind of a set piece because it was, my mind works a little bit like a old-time word processor. I kind of scan, and then I cut and paste in my own head as I go along. I think this is something you understand. This.
Me too.
Yeah. I think, I was getting this. I was reading this shit, and I was like, maybe Frank Moore and I are the same person. You know, I was thinking this.
N or... M, A, T, E, or mates.
Yes, definitely, for sure. but even possibly even the same person. Why couldn't there be a sharing of almost persona,
right,
or something that we don't even know,
right,
exactly what it is?
Right.
Like,
I could do your S, your show.
So, yeah, exactly. I could do yours. I love it. I think that...
Oh, he did that. There's a picture up there of Frank dressed as Elvis Presley.
Oh, yeah.
And he did that with an artist around who was popular around here that called himself Extreme Elvis.
Oh, yeah.
He was a big guy.
Yeah.
And he came out as the big Elvis, and that was his outfit. And he'd end up naked real fast.
Yeah.
And he did the peeing and pooping on the audience stuff. And just all this audience going out to the audience and trying to get them to, like, be there with him.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were mutually admiring each other. So he came up with the idea. He had this big date booked in a club in Oakland. He said, how about you be me, but we won't tell anybody. He didn't tell his band.
No.
He told one of his backup singers. That's all.
Right.
And he played Frank in the audience.
Wow.
And so the backup singer wheels Frank in, and the place is packed. He's like this hot act. You know? And the band, because they know he's always pulling fast ones, they just kind of go along with it.
Right.
It's like, oh, okay. And Frank does the whole show as him. And
you have video of that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And yeah.
Wow, that sounds so fantastic.
F-R, freaked, the L, the P, punks, freaked the punks out.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they started giving you, you mean when the band had to come to your rescue? No.
Joma Street.
Oh, wow. Well, so what we did was, there's this little all-age punk club down the street that's been around forever. And they were having this video festival, and they contacted us out of the blue. We're not really involved with them.
Right.
And said to Frank, could you submit something for us to play at this festival? So we had just done the show.
Right.
And then they needed like 15 minutes or something.
Right.
So he said, cut out the 15 minutes where the backup singer pees on me.
Right.
And so we play that. And here's this, like, you know, hardcore, like, you know, baby punks.
Yeah.
And they freaked out. Why did they freak out? Because they thought that Frank was not there of his own
free will. Yeah,
that he was being forced to be peed on and all this kind of stuff.
All right, yeah.
Which
it never ends. It just never ends.
That was the controversy.
The political correctness never ends.
Yeah,
it's funny because you're reminding me of a number of years ago, I guess it was around 1991. I got a call from Ron Delsner, who's the big rock and roll promoter in New York City, from his office. And they said that this band, now what the hell was the band's name? Oh, I can't believe I'm not going to remember the name of the band. Band is like they're the superstars of industrial music. Pig something. And it was like guy from the ministry, like there was guys from out here, from the ministry or whatever it's called. It was a super hardcore industrial band. It was all the stars of all the different bands, like a five different bands. They had the super band. And apparently they had requested me. So I go down there, and I'm talking to the guy on the phone from the office. I said, you know, I don't think so. I said, you know, the audience for this is like, you know, 16 to 24-year-old guys. I said, I work with like, you know, at that time I was doing a lot of work on rape and sexual abuse and shit like this. And I said, you know, my work's about rape and sexual abuse. And I said, you know, I have like six erotic dancer girls. And, you know, I said, and I went, and yeah. I think, yes, I should do this. The guy's like, huh? So I go there, and I start doing this piece, you know, and there's like, I don't know, like 400 hardcore boys on the floor, and I'm starting this piece, and it was some piece about sex. It was a sexual piece, and the girls are grinding and dancing, and the boys were just kept looking at the ground. You know, And then pretty soon it starts to look like oatmeal, you know? Like, they were getting annoyed, and they were like, they wouldn't look up, and they were like, it was bubbling like this. And finally this boy comes running up to front. He goes, "We don't want to hear any more of your sex stories."
Wow.
And I, yeah, and I was like, I had the mic, and I was like going, oh, I said, "It's true what they say about hardcore boys. It's the truth they say about hardcore boys." And I just, I got, you know, and it became really totally, it was like, you know, really intense. And I was like just going, and I just didn't stop, and I started talking about that there was a smell of new age order, you know, of the new world order was in the room, and I just kept going on and on, like more and more, and they were like freaking out, and I looked up, and there was the guy who was the roadie for the band, and I yelled, I said, "Hey," and then I said, "How long do I have to perform to get paid?" And the guy goes, 20 minutes. I said, "Okay." And I ended up like on one of the amps in the front, and I started talking to them very quietly. And I said, "Well, Pig Face, that's the name of the band." I said, "It's kind of a weird situation. You know, I said, you heard I've got to perform for 20 minutes in order to get paid. I said, I know you guys don't want to see me. And you don't want to hear anything that I'm doing." I said, "Even though Pig Face wants you to see me, that's why I'm here." And I went on. I did this whole long, very quietly emotional thing. And then I looked up and I said, "How much time do I have left?" He goes, "You just did 20 minutes. I went, "Bye." And we all walked off the stage. And then I went upstairs, and the guy from Pig Face, the main singer, is this little English guy who's quite famous, blonde guy. And I said, "Hey," I said, your audience are assholes." And he goes, "Yeah, I know." And he's doing push-ups. I said, "Are you doing push-ups?" I said, "To be pumped when you go on stage?" And he's doing the push-ups, and he goes, "No, it makes the acid come on faster."
Oh, wow.
And then I watched them, and they were like, their whole show was these young guys trying to get on stage and them beating them with their guitar and bass. You know, it was like the mosh pit scene, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then afterwards, I was upstairs, and like all these guys kept coming over and going, like, "Wow, you're way more hardcore than Pig Face."
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and you're cool. More hardcore than anybody.
Get what, when, I did the Outrageous Beauty Review, we P played my cast was M middle class people, and they didn't quite get really what we were doing.
Yeah.
You know, it was like we were like a community of people that had lived together for years. This was in the 70s, the mid-70s.
Yeah.
And so we were doing the show at the Mabuhay Gardens, which was like the punk club, and we were like the early show for 3.5 years, Saturday nights, sometimes another night. I opened, Frank opened for all, you know, the punk bands, you know. But the show itself was kind of like the cast, it was just an extension of our lives.
Right.
So
exactly.
They didn't really get how radical and subversive it was. They thought it was just us kind of playing. You know, we'd go off on Saturday nights, we'd put makeup on, and we'd play on the stage.
Right.
At A D I V E, and it was a dive, of course.
Yeah.
It was
a dive, of course.
And and so what is the point that they didn't U A B the P I the punks would Oh, well, like particularly like certain bands like Black Flag had a very heavy duty hardcore audience.
Right.
And they'd all be there for the early show. Right. And they'd like throw things at our cast and they'd scream and yell. And the cast was like, you know, very uncomfortable and didn't quite get that that was like okay.
Right.
And so Frank had the idea of he would just park himself on the stage like in the front corner.
Right.
And he would just scream back at them. So the show would be going on, and there's Frank doing that. Well, of course, these hardcore guys are like, I don't know what to make of Frank, you know. So he that would shut him up.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
They were R. E.
What's your name again?
A. Mikey.
Mikey, right.
L.
I was looking at all your tile work.
Really?
Love it.
They were really? T. A. M. Tame. K. Kids.
Yeah. There's a lot of that. There's a lot of that.
Yeah.
You're so brilliant, you know, creating this. You're like such a good designer, you know. I'm very impressed with that. I was looking at your paintings in the other house, and I see some here. Your paintings are really fucking phenomenal.
That is P A. Oh, that's Patty Smith. Frank put that
there
for you. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, Oh, well.
Uh-oh. Nice painting.
But I would say it has a real Patty thing going on there for sure.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think it's amazing. Your paintings are amazing. Your paintings are completely amazing. Yeah.
And you hear how he paints them? He can only... he would wear a hard hat with a paintbrush on it on his head. So he could only paint, like, that part of the canvas. So he'd have to paint it upside down and sideways to fill the whole canvas.
So you can get the whole thing on
it.
Yeah, but, I mean, isn't that amazing? Yeah. Because you're so, you're so unlinear.
Right.
Everything's coming from every direction. Inside out, upside down, around, around.
Right.
You know? And actually, I was thinking about something about that. I can't remember what it is now, but it'll come back because it always does with me. But I was like very, I was like saying to somebody the other day, because I went on your website and then I saw different things, right? And I was like, oh, he has a fucking painting. I'm like, how the fuck does he paint? Then I was over here in the house and looking at the paintings and I was like, and I said to the boys, I said, yeah, I said, that's crazy that he can paint like that. I said, because when I hug him, it's like hugging a dolphin. And I swam with the dolphins, so I know from where I speak. And also, when you were in the audience, and especially the first night, because you'd never seen me perform, then you were just having the experience of the performance, right? And you're like me, you're a great audience. You know, a lot of performers are not great audience because they suck.
Yes, I am a D made my made it P. I made it my business.
Yeah, of course, yeah. But it was so wonderful, especially the first night, right? Because I'd never experienced you either. So we were experiencing each other for the first time, and I don't really think there's a difference between the audience and the performer at all, right? So what was really incredible, because it was your first experience of it, so you were so vocal. And I know it was very powerful for me. I know it was really powerful for the audience because people can speak and they could make sounds that people understand. You were making these sounds that were so not just emotive, but they were so eloquent. You know, so we understood the very, what's the word? Very specifically, what you were feeling. We felt when you were expressing your isolation, when you were expressing your joy, when you were expressing your agreement, when you were expressing your pain, when you were expressing your understanding, you know, that was like fucking far out. You know, I was like really, it was really intense. It was really an amazing contribution, you know. And then when you came the second time, because of course by then you were like kind of more used to me, you know, just like I was more used to you. I mean, you can never have the first experience twice, right? That doesn't happen. So, but when I want to talk about the difference between the first time you came and my entering the stage, because I just started playing Creep there before I entered the stage, the Radiohead song, in 2006 in L.A. They asked me to do 5 performances for Outfest for their Platinum Center. And I have never, Bitch Dyke Fag Hag Whore has never been presented at a gay festival up until Outfest. And I was really angry, you know. So I didn't know I was angry. But when opening night came, I was in the audience with the dancers, and it had these wooden floors. It's a place called Red Cat in L.A. It's part of Cal Arts. And the music's playing of the song, and I was like just wandering around the audience, like looking pissed off and like just like sullen. And the song was playing, and I started stomping my feet. And it became this very threatening, and there was a guy who we brought from New York, Kevin Aviance, who's this black kind of dance music star who had just gotten beaten up within an inch of his life the month before. Terrible, terrible beating. He was, you know, fag bashed, and they broke his jaw and like all kinds of crazy shit. And I went to visit him in the hospital, and I thought, well, you know, he wasn't going to come to do the show in L.A. I mean, he had a wired shut jaw, and it was really fucked up. And I went to see him, and I said, you know, of course I was so, felt so bad, you know, about what had happened to him. But I was saying to him, but this is also important because it's you, there was visibility. A lot, I mean, it was on CNN and shit, you know. And I said, I feel bad that you're not going to be able to be in the show. And he's like, I'm in the show. So when we're in L.A., I stomped my foot, and it, the stage was kind of a wooden hollow thing. So you really heard the sound. Then he started stomping his feet. And pretty soon, all the dancers were stomped, and it was this very threatening, super threatening vibe. And we did it every night. So now we come here. We did 5 nights there. Then a year later, I did 1 performance at the Spiegel Tent in New York, where, by the way, it was a Tuesday night at 10:30 p.m., where, unbeknownst to me, in the contract, hidden, in fine print, which I didn't see, they took the first $4,000 that came in the door Tuesday night at 10:30 p.m. They did no publicity, no ads. I mean, they whatever their ad was, they maybe had me in their ad, but they wouldn't allow me to put postcards out in the venue for the months coming before my performance. So just wanted to add that because it's such an attractive story. And so we did 1 night, so we did Creep again. And I walked through the audience, like, and I was, of course, in a rage about that. So then this time, I said to Steve, he goes, I think it's a good idea to use Creep. And I said, oh, no, it has to be there now. Now it has to be there. I said, but I don't know what it's going to mean here. You know, I don't know what it's going to mean here.
Emma. Oh, most people did not know M. You. Most people didn't know you were you when you first came out.
Yeah. No, they didn't. And they were so mean to me, too, a lot of them.
Wow.
A lot of the people were really mean to me. They wouldn't look at me.
Right.
Or they would be like...
After I.G.A. gave you
a hug.
Away. After you gave her away.
You mean because I hugged you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, but I don't think they still knew, but the thing is that in that moment I was coming down and kind of carrying this feeling of not, it's not nice, you know, when you, I mean, there's a big element of sacrifice in my work. I always have a sacrificial element.
Yes.
So you go, and I'm a weird person because I'm a real person, you know.
Yes.
I'm not Patti Smith, which isn't, you know, I think Patti's a great artist, but Patti's personhood, she hasn't been involved with that for a long time.
Frank freaked her out.
Oh, definitely.
She didn't know what to make of him.
No.
She asked for him to read her future as if this was a Ouija board. She didn't even get that it was a communication device. And when he was still just like relating to her and not doing her future, she got mad. I said no. He said, no, I won't read your future.
No, but the thing is, of course, because you are an intuitive being, you know, even if you didn't have cerebral palsy, you would still be an intuitive being. I mean, this is part of your nature, right? But being an intuitive being in this package, right, which immediately, this is what I always say to people. People always want to say that my work is confrontational. I always say, I don't agree with you. My work is not confrontational. I said, people confront themselves so easily. You don't need, no artist has to confront anybody because people are so busy confronting themselves.
Yes.
So,
you don't know what PU pushes people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, for me, you are difficult. You are intense. Now I know you, you know, but the first day I didn't know, you know, and none of us want to not know. People don't want to not know how to be at ease in a situation. So you're in a conflict right away between, you know, being able to say, I know how to deal with this. You know, I was in Australia, and there's a cafe called the Piccolo, and it's like a totally, totally bohemian place, very tiny. You know, like it maybe has like, I don't know, like maybe 15 or 20 seats. And it's open till 6 o'clock in the morning. And I always go there, right? And there's this, and you are a cat. And there was this Aboriginal guy in there. And I'm talking with the Aboriginal guy, right? And he's drunk. And he's a poor Aboriginal guy, right? But I'm like talking to him and... But then he started to get sexual with me because I was talking with him. And then we started to have a physical fight. And then he got thrown out, and I felt really bad because the whole situation was a kind of misunderstanding. And afterwards, I was talking to somebody, and I said, yeah. I said, I was there thinking, wow, Aboriginal people like me. You know, I'm all proud. You know what I mean? So, you know, people are going to have their thing. I'm like, oh, you know, I get along with Frank Moore, and he's like, you know, has cerebral palsy, and I, you know, can, you know. But there is an element, I think. I mean, I don't want to, like, talk. I mean, I think it's a great portrait of Patty. To me, it looks really, and I knew Patty very, 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 very well at one point. She and I were very, very close friends at one point. And then Patty convinced me that I should leave New York and go to Europe, because she said, we're just slaves here, man. We're just slaves here. We're just slaves. And so I believed her, and I went. You know, and, you know, and I think that, you know, she did become what she really wanted to be, which was a rock star, you know. And, but I'm not, I don't know how to say it without, because I don't want to trash her, but I want to say, of course, she couldn't be in that space with you, you know, without a construct, you know. And what the fuck does that mean, that you're going to tell her fucking future? Yeah. That's retarded, yeah. You know? Like, yeah. That's like, that's being unwilling to ask a question. Mm. You know, like, hey, okay, you're here. What the fuck is this?
Right.
You know?
Right.
Not like, oh, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to get all Tennessee Williams on you, you know, and make you, like, you know, you're this figure, you know, like a, you know, in one of his plays where he always has like some shamanistic voodoo, you know, black bone and a crow thing, you know. But that's what I think happens to people who believe their own publicity. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so when I'm saying that for me, because I am a real person and because I have suffered a lot in my life. It doesn't take much for me to be like, if I'm coming down the stairs and I'm looking at people, I am ambivalent about, not about being a performer, because I know I'm an entertainer. Mm. I'm very clear on that, that's what I do. I'm an entertainer. But I am ambivalent about taking the attention. You know what I mean? Of being the center of attention. Like, I like it, but not so much, you know? And then I'm not really an exhibitionist, unlike you.
You are A-C-O-N-D. You. Conductor?
Yeah, I'm a conductor. Yeah. And I'm a reformer. This just came up. I think you'd be very... I want to send you the... it hasn't come out yet, but there's two essays on my work, you know, and I think you would enjoy reading them. I want to share them with you. But one guy is this guy, Ken Bernard, who's an amazing playwright of the ridiculous, but not camp. Like, really dangerous shit, you know? And I did his plays when I was just 17, 18, 19. The last one I did, I was 20, with the playhouse, The Ridiculous. And he's like 80 years old, and I, because of my background, the immigrant Italian peasant thing, really hard for me to ask anybody for anything, you know? It's not in my culture, you know, how I was raised. So I never would invite him or invite anybody to see my work, you know. My whole relationship has been with the general public, you know. And so finally, in 2005, I invited him to come and see a performance that I was doing. It was a club work. I wasn't doing like a full show. And then I asked him, because Semiotex was going to do this book on my work, I asked him, I wrote to him, I said, look, you know, I'd like you to see my work, and I sent him like seven or eight scripts. And I said, you know, I don't expect you to write anything about me, but you did know me from when I was this very young performer. And, you know, if you felt like you had something to say, right? And he wrote this amazing fucking essay without ever seeing any of the DVDs of the work, which is really important because what I write and how I stage it are very different, you know. And he got it, totally got it. But one of the things he wrote about was about me as a reformer. And it was very interesting to me because I am a reformer. Just, you're a reformer also.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you see that things could be better, that we are limited, that we can be so much more. There's so much, so much more, so much more to go and have and be and et cetera. So when I'm coming down the stairs and these people are like looking at me, and the last night was the worst. Saturday night was the fucking worst because I'm coming down the stairs and I'm like just like, you know, kind of hanging on, you know, and people were like,
oh my,
like this, just like, you know, or the look. And then some people smiled and were nice, but a lot of people weren't, you know. So by the time I get down to the floor, I'm feeling like, what am I doing, you know. So the first night this was happening, when I got down to you, by that time, I was like, wow, I feel like I'm a creep, but Frank's a real creep, you know? And that, when we embraced, you know, in that communication between the two of us, right, because it's so easy for you, because of your experience, to read the dynamic that was in the room. You automatically knew everything that I was doing, you know, like you didn't have to explain anything, right? Of course, right? And then when I was going towards the stage and then I kept looking back to you and there was this very taut. The energy was very taut. It was like we had this almost like elasticy thing because it was, I could move, but then I was pulled back like this. And then without even, and I didn't know anything about your life at all because I hadn't read the thing yet and I hadn't gone on your website yet, right? And then I was like having it all. And I have to tell you now, I realized something I said I didn't remember for a long time. When I was in seventh grade, my life was really, really horrible. And you heard some of it, you know, like everybody said I was like, you know, fucking everybody. And plus I had a horrible home life. And my father was in a mental hospital and supposedly because he was going to drown me. And, of course, in a southern Italian family, it's not a buried memory because you can't have a buried memory in a southern Italian family because as soon as you're 5 years old, they start screaming, and your father was going to drown you, you know. And, you know, and so I had all these things going on plus all the, like, insane tension, and now I found out even more crazy stuff that I didn't know since my mother died. And I was acting out all the time because I was like totally under contents, under pressure. When I went to seventh grade, and this time in seventh grade, I used to write all over my arms, all over my legs. I would write all over myself. And I was like totally persona non grata. And there was a boy with cerebral palsy. And he was mobile. He was mobile, and I would imitate him. And now I didn't remember. This is many years later, you know. And at that time, I was like saying to the boys, I said, you know, I didn't tell them that I imitate him. I couldn't get myself up to that till now, you know. But, you know, same with the boys that, you know, probably in now, if it would be now, you would get oriented, like the teachers would tell you about, you know, here's a special needs kid, blah, blah, blah. Then they didn't tell you anything. And he was, like, always in the basement, you know, like in some special classes or something. And I almost never saw him. And I wouldn't, like, imitate him in front of him. Do you know what I mean? But I would do it to make everybody laugh, you know, because I felt so fucking rotten, you know. And now I'm thinking, like, fuck, this probably was this fucking brilliant fucking guy that I was completely even unaware of anything, you know what I mean? Yeah, I forgive myself, but still, you know. Anyway, yeah, so anyways, then the second time when you came, I got freaked out because you were on the other side of the room. Right?
Yes.
I come in the room.
Us too, really.
I come in the room and I'm like,
because I of the S T
stage
E
oh, no.
step
oh steps yeah right right right
step
right, but I didn't think of it right. So I come in and I'm like, where the fuck's Frank? You know, I'm like, what the fuck? You know, and then I see you're on the other side of the stage, and I was like, this is not good. You know, because I'm thinking, because I was already back in, like, what we did the first time, you know what I mean? Right. I liked it, you know what I mean? Right. I was like, fuck, I want that again, you know? But of course, you know that you can never have the same thing again, right? But it doesn't stop you from wanting it, right? Maybe not you.
Don't age. Oh, hold.
Yeah, on. I know, you gotcha. I'm a fast assimilator. But then you're on the other side. So I said, fuck, okay, what am I going to do? So I thought, all right, I'm going to do it different this time, right? And I'm going to go. So I went on the other, I always go down the steps on the side that you were, but I was like, this isn't the same because I was going to get your back. You know what I mean? Like I wasn't, you know. But then I said, well, too bad. Just go and do it. You know, just do what's in front of you. So I did it. Then when I came down, then a whole other thing happened. You know, it was like very exciting. And I think that they videoed that night. I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, I think that's right.
They did. Yeah. And then that was really interesting that it was also kind of like the inverse energistically of what happened the first night. So it was kind of very ritualistic, you know, that you were there the first time and then the last time, you know, in this like other place, right? And there's like kind of an algebra of, an algebra of alchemy, right? Yeah, so I was like, and I really loved it when I was going up on the stage and still maintaining this contact with you, you know. And maybe I might have thought that it might not have worked over such a distance, but I guess because we had already practiced with the shorter distance, then it still was.
And D. I distance
doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Ha ha ha. I jumped you. I jumped you. I jumped you. Yeah, that was exactly, that was fucking far out. And ask me some questions.
We are always the O-U-T outsiders.
Yeah.
I of all the subcultures, that we get involved in. Mm-hmm.
Influence. Absolutely.
But they F R freak out.
Well, this is what I said to my dancers the other night, you know, that we had in the week since I had seen you. This big, huge drama happened with the genderqueer kids who were coming to the show, and I was talking about the trendiness around certain trans thing, and nobody wants to be a lesbian anymore, and everybody wants to be a boy, and the prestige that's in the being a boy, blah, blah, blah. And well, unbeknownst to me, one Sunday night, this past Sunday night, I'm talking all this stuff, and then I show the video of my mother, and this young man comes over to me, and he says, listen, he goes, I think you're awesome. He goes, but I want to talk to you about the trans. He goes, you know, your ideas about the trans men, you know, are I want to have a conversation with you about it. And I said, he was very nice. I was like, okay. I said, but I wasn't talking about trans men. He goes back to his seat. I go on stage, and I'm thinking, Penny, just do the show and do not veer off into this special interest thing. But no.
Didn't take your own advice.
No. So I started to talk to him, and I said, I want to say this person, this young man came up to me and said XYZ, and I want to say this to him now. He stands up, and I'm like trying to say what I'm saying, and he's like saying stuff to me, you know, like, you know, you don't know anything about trans. And I'm not talking about trans men, you know. And I've got this one peculiar problem that if I don't think we're talking about the same thing, I won't continue the conversation until we can get that we're both talking about the same thing. Right. Oh, my God. Well, he went to leave, and I said, you're going to fucking walk out? I said, I've just shown you this tremendous respect by stopping the whole show to answer and talk to you about this. I said, sit the fuck down. So he sat down, but he still didn't like it, and he ended up walking out. Then at the end of the night, it turned out that all of my girl dancers were genderqueer identified and either involved with trans men or very, you know, if not partnering up or very involved. And they were all really upset. Really upset, and I was trying to talk to them, and like, you know, and they're all young, you know, they're all like, you know, I mean, Nina's the oldest, and she's like 35, you know, and so it was really interesting. And then it was really hard for me because, you know, it's like, I'm very soft-hearted. I mean, I'm very tough, absolutely, but I'm very, very, very soft-hearted, and it was hard for me to be in this situation with them. And at the same time, what I wanted to say to them is like, you know, I'm fucking twice your fucking goddamn fucking age. Like, you're gonna get in my face, you know? Like, don't get in my face, you know? And but then you can't say that to them because I've learned, you know, because that's the kind of entitlement generation, you know, and it's different from my generation, which is the earning. You earn the respect as opposed to you're entitled to the respect.
Right.
But they don't understand that, so you can't even say that because it doesn't mean anything to them.
Right.
They don't know what you're talking about. And also because empathy has been bred out of the culture, you know, people have lost one of our great capacities, which is our ability to be empathetic and to empathize and like be able to empathize with you or with you or with you. You know, you say five sentences and your empathy gets aroused and you have the capacity to see it from your point of view, right? But that's gone. Anyways, I was really physically sick also. That was the worst part. It was my sickest, right? really bad bronchitis and so
that
no energy. And
is always when these things happen.
Yeah, right. Okay, cool. I'm with you. And so anyways, I tried to talk to them and I said, look, I said, I'm going to investigate this. So, you know, I found this guy who's a pagan trans man in Massachusetts with an incredible analysis and, you know, he's disabled, but he's like doing this wild shit and he's a shaman. I think maybe I've got to send you his link because I'll send you the letters he wrote that were very great, you know. So anyway, I went back. This was then two more people were writing to me that were either trans identified or genderqueer identified and starting right away with you're a fucking racist, but you know, it was disgusting to watch you describe your dancers by the color of their skin.
I don't even know what all of that means. Those types.
Oh,
is that what you mean?
You mean like the
trans identified?
You don't know what that means. Okay, so you know that there's a big movement now because it's 2009, where people who have body dysmorphia.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they can get sex reassignment surgery,
yes.
Right? Well, then there's also the gender queer movement. Do you know that?
No.
Okay, so this is people who don't identify with the bit, but what is it called? Binary? The two male-female culture. So they're like, they reject binary. That there's just two sexes, and they're gender fluid. So one day they're, you know, girly, and one day they're not, or whatever the fuck they are.
Like me, like we.
Yeah.
Like we do, like we all do, are, like we all are.
Right, and this is... Exactly, but without it being institutionalized.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
One of the things that I was trying to explain is that in the 60s, people fought and worked very hard for the idea that gender and genitalia were not connected, right? But now, of course, because it's 40 years later and these kids are young and they don't, all the people died in the middle. From AIDS or from ODs of drugs. I mean, a lot of alternative people are gone. There's not a lot of people in our age group, right? You're the same age as Patty, by the way, in case you didn't know. Everybody's 5 years older than me. 5 years. You're 46?
He's 60.
No, I said he. But
oh,
he's born
yes, 45. Wait, 6, 25, 46. 46.
Yeah, you're born 46.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Patty's either born, she may be born in 45, because she's 5 years older than me. I'm born in 50. You're a mere 4 years older than me. Don't get too upstarted. And so a lot of people are gone in the middle generation.
B. Baby, you're a baby.
I was just saying today to the guy who did my hair. Do you see my hair is a new color? I don't know. Like he just did my hair for me. Mr. Anthony. Mr. Anthony was born in 1968. And I said, he was doing my hair today. And I said, born in 1968? I said, shit. I said, you were in a crib. And I was doing LSD. I said, you couldn't even get out of the crib. Couldn't even talk. I was doing LSD. I was eating pizza. You could only drink milk. So that's what was going on with you. You were bigger than me. So anyways, so what happened was I said, when I entered into a dialogue, I'm sick and I'm writing these people 5-6 emails a day. You know, and they're still not, you know, coming. You know, like I'm writing them and saying, like, oh, you know, first of all, you know, I was in the original genderfuck thing, Playhouse of Ridiculous. We started genderfuck, you know, and then, like, you know, like, don't say I'm racist because I got beaten up in the street from when I was 12 years old for being a nigger lover. So, like, don't even. You know, don't even say that to me because you don't know what you're talking about because I live my politics with my body on the street, not on a velour couch with six people who took the same black studies class as me, you know. And then when I went back to work because I had 2 days off, Monday and Tuesday, everybody wanted to have a meeting. And I was like, okay, we'll have a short meeting, like a 15-minute meeting.
What is this D-E-M democracy?
Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah.
I am the C-R-E-A creative.
Yeah. But, you know, like, I still understood because it's still my big joke about it in the show is, and I might have said it tonight that you were there, you know, like, right, there's a whole bunch of heterosexuals here who don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. There's a whole bunch of fags here who could fucking care less. And the end result is lesbians, genderqueer girls, and ex-girls who are now men, who care about this, you know? I mean, it you know, it's not universal, you know? And so anyways, I went in and I said to them, I said, look, this is what I've been doing. I've been talking to all these people. I'm gonna be more articulate. I wasn't articulate enough. I have to give more history because people don't know what I'm talking about. And then I said, and I almost started crying, but I didn't cry, but almost. And I just said, you know, I said, all I know is I stick up for everybody and nobody ever fucking sticks up for me, you know?
Yes, I have the same experience.
Yeah.
Frank is always talking about loyalty. He's being loyal.
Yeah, right. And steadfast. And steady, yeah. And also, the reality is that you can't attain mastery if you don't fucking go through the journey to mastery. You know, it's not like, and this is one of the things that's really missing. So, you know, most young people, because they're in a culture of being experts, they're all experts, you know. And I don't know if it was the night that you were there or I was like started ranting about be young, you know. No, I was like one night I just started ranting. I was like just going, you know, you're young for such a short amount of time and you're old for a really fucking long time. So like fucking young up, man, you know, be young, you know, like stop with this, you know, how, you know, and I understand that someone could be 29 and often people do feel older when they're around 29, 30, because they feel like they've lived a while, right? Like 15 years, you know? Since they were 15, they were kind of conscious of being alive in the world, you know what I mean? So they think, wow, 15 years, and they get tired, you know, and they feel like, you know, they've really been through something.
B-Y-B-U-R. Burned out.
You burned out. Exactly. Exactly. You're so smart. You're so smart. Exactly. So they have that feeling that they're older, you know. And then, like, last night it made some people mad because I was like, I'm like, you know, this person was, you know, wrote to me. So, you know, I'm 29 years old. And I said, yeah, 29. That's like 11. It's the same as 11. What's 29 years old? It's like 11 years old. And then somebody got mad at me about saying that. But I just think it's a message of hope, you know?
That they think they are S-P-E, special?
Yeah. Yeah, people think they're special, which is really problematic, right? Because,
For B E C because everybody is special. Right. Everybody G O go T through the same. Everyone goes through the same things.
Yeah. Well, yes and no, because like in my show, Bad Reputation, I say there are women who've always been protected and there are women who've never been protected. And the idea that you can protect yourself is absurd, because protection implies that somebody else is looking out for you. When you're alone, the most you can do is defend yourself. Defense and protection are not the same thing. So, I mean, you can have people, if you don't have a rigorous inquiry in what it is to be alive, if you don't have, and not everybody does, you know, not everybody does, that's, we all have our nature, you know, like, you know, I happen to be a very altruistic person. That's my nature. I'm not like an especially great, nice person. I am compelled to be altruistic because it's my nature. It's not something that I struggle to develop in myself, right? Yet I believe that I don't know if I believe, I should say I feel that if you're alive, that you have to, that if you're awake and you're aware, then you're going to have an inquiry into what it is to be alive. Now, I also do believe that there's only 10,000 people alive on the planet at any one time, as Ouspensky said. And I amended it to say there's only 10,000 people alive on the planet at one time, and 6,000 of them are Aboriginals, you know. So, you know, I mean, and that's like, you know, because I'm a non-elitist and I'm a populist. So for many, many, many years, I truly did believe that everybody was equally intelligent. And then I had to realize that...
I-N-I-N-S P in spite of all evidence.
It's, yeah, right, to the contrary. Right, but now as I'm saying this to you, I'm actually coming up with something. And that is that while all people do not share the same level of intelligence, all people do have the ability to have the same level of cognizance, which of course is different from...
If they are
respectful.
Responsive.
Oh, response.
Responsible.
Responsible.
If they are responsible.
Yeah. Right, you have to have some fucking modesty. I mean, you have to have some modesty and you have to have some... I mean, what I don't like about the current youth culture is it kind of like wants to fool young people into thinking that they're all that. Like, in my young time was also youth culture, right? Mid-60s. But we didn't believe it. When they said, oh, the young people are the tastemakers, the young people are the... We didn't believe it. You know what I mean? That's the difference, you know? Because when I was, like I said last night, nobody who's young is cool. When you're young, the most you can do is you try not to be uncool. so that cool people will let you hang out with them, because you learn how to be cool. Nobody's just inherently cool because they're young. That's like retarded, you know, like that's not possible. But I do believe that we all, like, I just was in, I was in Turkey in September, and I was in the a lot of markets with these women who are coming down from the mountains, and they don't even speak Turkish, you know, they're like sort of tribal women. And I would be having these, like, you know, hour-long conversations with these people just with looking and body language, because they haven't lost the capacity to communicate that way, you know? And, you know, you can communicate with some quite deafness of emotion like you and I are doing right now, you know?
Yes.
And that's a kind of cognizance, right? That doesn't have to do, I mean, it can be aided by intelligence. Can be aided by intelligence, but the absolute ability.
It is E-R-O, erotic.
Erotic?
That
well, oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's a property of Eros, absolutely. Yeah. Absolute, without a doubt, yeah. But that's part of our, I guess, our animal nature, no? Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. Ask me a new question.
I. H.
You can't throw a. Frank Moore.
I had. A. B. L, A, black, H, I, hip hop, artist, D, no, S, A, say, he, G, F, E, felt. F O F O R forced to or forced to be H G A gay. He felt forced. He was saying that now it's not, this is the last time he was on the show. He said, it's now what's cool is being gay. And that he feels like it's not, like now he's being treated as if being straight is not cool, it's not acceptable. And he's feeling like there's a pressure for him to be gay.
It's interesting because the ending story of the story about the genderqueer thing in my dancers was that last night was the last night of the show, and one of my dancers who was the most upset during this altercation last week came up to me at the closing night party and very serious, and she told me that her lover and her friends came to the show last night, and her friends had never seen her in her erotic dancer persona. And they said to her that she looked really straight when she was dancing, and that she didn't look queer. And she ended up just sobbing and was being very upset after the show. I didn't see this. Other people saw this. And then when she told me last night, I was looking at her and I said, well, I said, that's full circle, isn't it? You know, and then she admitted that, you know, she often feels like she's, you know, being challenged that she's not queer enough, you know. And this is like counter-revolutionary and counter-evolutionary.
Yes, yes.
And all of these kind of identity, the way identity politics hijacked what was going on in the 60s. Because in the 60s, I think we can safely say this,
yes.
right? People that were our age, we were not racist. We were not homophobic. We were not misogynist because that was part of what we saw that we called, you know, plastic or bad, or we distanced ourselves. Like we were on, even if we had no experience with homophobia, let's say, or with racism, we still decided to take it on, how do I say it, to just take it on something that we did not agree with that, you know? So I
yes.
think for our generation, you know, things were moving along. That's why I say in the mid-70s, then the whole thing was hijacked by these people who came out of the closet and went on committees, telling the rest of us who'd never been in the closet, you know, what we could, and they actually hijacked the entire discourse, and along with a lot of other things, including feminism, these things were not allowed to go into the widest margins of society. In my show, Bad Reputation, I say, do you actually think it's because of men that feminism hasn't spread to the widest margins of society? No, it's because of women, you know? And the same thing with the gay rights issue, you know, in the mid-70s, it got hijacked, you know, in one way. And then after AIDS, AIDS was like, gave the same kind of sympathy to the gay world as 9/11 gave to America. And just like the way America squandered the goodwill of the world's people, you know, by, you know, going into Iraq and doing all these criminal acts, the goodwill that came to the gay world because of AIDS was squandered because the so-called gay community, instead of using this as a time to educate and include the public, they just turned it into a marketing strategy and started selling people shit. And if you want to sell people shit, you've got to keep them in a small group, you know. You know, Quentin Crisp said, do you know Quentin Crisp?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Quentin Crisp, we did many shows together, and at that time I was like really an AIDS activist. I mean, I still am an AIDS activist, I guess, but at that time I was very busy with it, and I was very, very angry, and Quentin would always disagree with activism. He just disagreed with it, and he said it didn't work. Of course, he's an Edwardian, so he's coming from a different time, right? But he said to me, and it was always very intense for me, he said, the so-called gay community says that it wants it wants equality, but what it wants is acknowledgement. Because when you say you want equality, you say, I'm gay, and people say, oh, do and people say, so what? But when you want acknowledgement, you say, I'm gay, and people say, oh, do tell, what was it like for you? You know? And so that's that thing about being special, you know? And I've done a lot of stuff on this aspect. And also these young people want to be special. You know, their genderqueer revolution is something that they think is totally new. You know, the trans man, his name is Raven from Massachusetts, wrote and said, look, you know, in 10 years these kids are not going to be genderqueer, right? He said, but maybe it will have softened up their opinions towards trans people so that it'll be easier for the future generations of people who really do have body dysmorphia and who want to, you know, segue into different body types, right? And then what he was saying, which was quite interesting too, because I think the lesbian view on it is protectionist. You know, it's like, oh, here's these young kids and they're taking testosterone and they're cutting off their breasts and they're very young. And, you know, what if it's, you know, what if they're just doing it to curry favor or to, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that was one of the things that made the guy mad, the trans man mad, because I was trying to explain to him what I was saying. I told him about Quentin Crisp and I going into like a leather bar. And Quentin Crisp said, he goes, they look marvelous, Miss Arcade, but it can't be true about all of them. And I was like, what do you mean? And he said, when I was young, if someone told me that there was a tavern in the town where the beautiful and the cruel were gathered, I would have run all the way there, and I would have gone up to the largest and the leatheriest of them, and I would have said, if you love me, kill the bartender. He said, and they won't do it. They're standing there squeaking with leather, studded with steel, and they're talking about the ballet. And so, you know, there is this element of people who don't look, you know, where they just want to look like something and they're really not like that. It's like when I see people who are dressed super punk, you know, young people in an elevator at the Chelsea Hotel.
They should. They even ever, always, they always are the O-N-E, the ones who, W, who have the M-O, most, I-N, inhibitions.
Uh-huh. It's true. You're right. You're absolutely correct.
We did a piece, the erotic play, for like a number of years. Frank would go up to people and ask if he could do a video of them just being who they are. And he said the idea was to show sexy as just normal people as opposed to like the Playboy Hollywood idea.
Right.
And for 3.5 years, we were videoing people like 8-10 hours a day, 2 hours at a time. And every single time, the people that, well, we figured this out slowly, but the people that looked really interesting and really hip, they were so not open.
Yeah.
Yet he'd get like these secretaries from the art department or from any history department that would come on their lunch break and they would look so straight. And I'm thinking, oh, right, Frank, you know, boom, clothes off, playing with the costumes, doing just being playful and open. With no, like, nothing to, no image to protect or to.
Right.
It was just, they were just there.
Yeah.
To be with us and to have fun.
Yeah, yeah.
Happened like that every time.
Yeah, no, absolutely, it's true.
Yeah.
It's really funny because I go to certain events, you know, and because I have ties in the punk, you know, world. Mm. And there'll be these young people and, like, I'll go, because I just dress like whatever I'm dressing like. I mean, it could be anything, you know what I mean? And then you'll be in the elevator with them and they'll be like just looking at you and be just like, you know.
How uncool.
Yeah, exactly, how uncool, you know. And you just, and then they find out that you're somebody.
Right.
And then they're like, you know, then they really feel like they're really superior to you. And I've had a few conversations with people where I'm like going, well, you know, if you're so fucking cool, why are you dressed the way I used to dress 30 years ago? Why don't you come up with something new? You know, I said, because like when I see you in your full punk regalia, it looks like Elvis in 1976 to me. It looks exactly the same, you know. It's like, you know, it doesn't look fresh. It looks like, you know, you look a little weird, you know, like, it, you know. But also, I mean, the other thing is, like, I do a lot of benefits. And we're doing, like, for quite a while, for Mumunia. Yeah. And these people would come in full fucking heavy-duty regalia with, like, you know, $10 worth of fucking wax in their hair and, like, you know, $250 Doc Martin shoes, and then you ask them to throw a dollar in the box to get a bus to go to Philadelphia, and they wouldn't do it, you know? And I would, like, flip out on them. I would always, like, just flip out on them. But it's true. It's like, that's very telling, you know. Yeah.
Want to H E here A C L A S classic?
Yeah, yeah.
L E letter?
Yeah.
Is this Linda? Mm-hmm. Linda's letter? Mm-hmm. Oh, say what it is about. Okay. So, when the group broke up that was doing the show at the Mabuhay Gardens, yeah. We were like 30 of us, and that all broke up.
Yeah.
And in an effort to hook up with other people doing creative things, Frank came up with this idea, oh, I'll go to art school and get another master's degree.
Right, right.
Because he already had one master's degree. B.A. It was a bad idea. Because we're thinking this is where all these creative people would
be.
So we go to the San Francisco Art Institute. And we didn't, you know, what department? And we didn't care, you know. And so we picked video because we thought that would be fun to know how to work video equipment and stuff. This was like in like 80, 81, something like that.
Oh, wow.
And but the department was performance/video.
Right.
And so we had been doing stuff for like 15 years and not knowing it was called performance art.
Right.
We were just like doing stuff Frank would come up with.
Right.
Oh. The Outrageous Beauty Review was very got a lot of international press.
Right.
So it was like well known and
I know about
so
that.
So we go to the school and nobody would talk to us. Not even the teachers. Mm. We were just like as if we were invisible. And
wow.
2 years. It was a 2-year program. I mean, I was ready to quit after a week, you know. Frank was like this, you know. But it was rough. I mean, it was. I would be spelling Frank's board, and they would pretend it wasn't happening. And this is like the teachers. And there was one class that was the graduate class where everybody goes to each other's performances and you talk about it. That's all the class is. Only one guy would come to Frank's performances, and they would pretend they wouldn't even talk about it. And so the very last semester, they have this guest teacher, Linda Burnham, who was the founder and publisher of this performance art magazine, High Performance, which, because we didn't know anything about performance art,
I remember
we didn't know the magazine, we didn't know to be impressed by anything.
Right, right.
And she, of course, comes right up to Frank and wants to befriend him and know him. And she started coming over to our house and inviting all of her famous artist friends up from L.A. to meet Frank and puts him on the cover of the magazine. Well, you know, we don't even still know to be impressed, you know, because we've been getting a lot of publicity.
Right, it wasn't something,
But everybody, but we knew by the way everybody was acting in the school. It's like, how did he get on the cover, you know? So Frank always said this was his revenge, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, we have a friendly relationship with her. We would get together all the time after the school thing. Whenever we were in L.A., we'd get together. Whenever she was up here, we'd get together. And she was very supportive of us and Frank and the work we did. And, you know, Frank was always kind of having run-ins with somebody, and she was always supportive of our end of it.
Right.
And I was D S I was W A R warning A artists two at if they did not S T O, stop, the, P, PC. Some, one, like, M, A, M, E, E, Meese, who was like the Meese Commission.
Right, Commission, absolutely.
It would open the door for somebody like that to come in.
Absolutely.
And clamp down on everybody
right.
if everybody didn't stop picking
right,
at each
right,
other.
Right, absolutely.
They were P, I, pissed at you for talking like that.
Yeah.
And at the time, it seemed like he was pulling it out of the air.
Right.
You know, there was no context for it. And
yeah,
so,
but you're prescient.
Yes. So she had come to one performance that we did in L.A., Linda.
Mm-hmm.
P-U-B, public, P-U-N. Oh, right. She came to that other thing, too, the punk club. Right. Okay. But she hadn't come to one of these, like, five-hour things that Frank was doing. And so, finally, we were both going to be in the same city, and she was real excited. We had gotten together with her for lunch, and I can't wait to finally da-da-da-da. So, if she hadn't come, and, you know, I mean, it's like people always don't come.
Yeah.
And, but we get this. This is the letter we get
right.
a few days later.
Read it.
Okay, this was July 1989.
Mm-hmm.
Dear Frank and Linda, I was sorry to disappoint you by not showing up at your performance last weekend. I put myself in the ridiculous position of needing a ride and couldn't get anyone to bring me there. The real problem, though, is that I was reluctant to go. I think you hit the nail on the head, Linda, when you said it seems to be hard to get people you know to participate. I think I was really afraid to be put in the position of interacting, quote, erotically in public with friends. I think I learned a lot about erotic play during the 70s through performance, and it's not fear of the unknown. It's just sort of abhorrent, the thought of facing decisions about that with friends, and in front of friends and readers, etc. I'd rather carry out those experiments in other ways. I've spoken with a lot of people in San Francisco about your problems there, and the way they seem to feel is that your work is therapy, not art. By that, they mean that it has a function as an interpersonal exploration, but it doesn't address the concerns that they are honestly interested in as part of the current art dialogue, whether it be mainstream or, quote, alternative. I explain that the fact that you have an audience means you are doing work that is valuable. But the general feeling is that even if you are an artist and it's art because you say it is, that doesn't mean everybody has to be interested in it or that curators and presenters are obliged to show it. Most feel it doesn't belong in an art gallery, but in your own studio or school, with you taking the responsibility yourself. I do agree that erotic play is not concurrent with what's being looked at in art. And for many people,
what?
Such performance brings back awful memories of things tried in the 70s that proved to be embarrassing for all concerned. The only advantages you gain by showing in a gallery is exposure to their audience and a certain stamp of approval from the space itself. I don't think there's any reason to battle with them if they simply don't want your work in their space. Even if you have them on a technicality, you should just let it go. I really love you both and feel you are to be congratulated for your courage and determination. I hate it when they say they love me,
yeah.
but
yeah, truly.
The fact that you have a group of students now and are making something of a living from what you do is phenomenal. That doesn't mean art presenters and editors are obliged to deal with it, especially if they already have.
You should get a fucking MacArthur.
It seems this is a time when you are going to have to carry the burden of presenting yourself in your own sphere or in places you rent and not try to force others to present you. I think that's the appropriate way for you to go and, as you said, reduces the problems and disappointments. I know this is a little bit of a reversal on what I had said about the job of art spaces and about charges of old-fashioned and fear of nudity. But having examined my own feelings about coming to the piece in L.A., I have a little more insight into some of the reluctance you come up against. The other thing that bothers people about dealing with you, Frank, is that they are very offended by the way you seem to use your handicap as a kind of force to get your way. In some ways, it's interesting to consider that a physically disadvantaged person can actually grab power by using psychological force on others. But in truth, it's a bit unfair. You seem to have a compulsion.
What? This is psychotic.
You seem to have a compulsion not to take no for an answer under any circumstances and to use as your weapon other people's reluctance to appear prejudiced. You might want to examine your methods and goals and consider whether your style constitutes undue force and whether that is acceptable to you.
Undue force! Slap her!
A lot of people have said that it does, and force is unacceptable to most of us. As far as our relationship goes, I would rather go on being your friend than your helper in the art world. I think High Performance and I have both given you a lot of help. I hate when they say that. Have given you a lot of help and would rather not be put on the spot anymore. So in the future, let's just relate as friends. I'd like to hear about your adventures, but I don't want to be involved in the process anymore. It's just not interesting enough to me to deal with the struggle. It creates an awful lot of enemies somehow, and that has just as much to do with your attitude as it does with other people's. I am not a soldier, I am a mediator. I know that this letter will make you want to fire off a rejoinder and shoot my letter full of holes, but that is really going to endanger our friendship. I'm having a
whoa! Hard enough time. This woman is fucked up.
I'm having a hard
enough. So wait a minute, hold on a second.
Yeah.
So she wants to stop being involved with you as an art curator, creature, power broker, and just wants to be friends. But if you write her a letter telling her how you feel, it's going to endanger your friendship.
Exactly.
You know, these people should all kill themselves. I mean, that's my only response. You know, I'm sorry, I want you to keep reading. I just want to say that I have spent my entire career making people angry at me who have jobs in the arts. And, you know, one of the things that used to make them really mad at me was I used to say publicly all the time, you know, if you have a paying job in the arts and you're not in service to artists, then you should kill yourself. You know, that's...
Yes.
It's the beginning and the end of it. I mean, the fact... I mean, you don't have to have more than 5 brain cells to understand that Frank has developed, you know, a tremendous vision in art, first of all, under extraordinary circumstances that even somebody who's fully bodily able, blah, 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 didn't have a million fucking obstacles in their way. But then, you know, I mean, of course, this letter is written in 89. You know, now it's 2009. So we're already talking 20 years later. You know what I mean? So when somebody consistently makes work over this amount of time.
I was doing. She started in the late 60s. So we had already been going 20 years by the time she wrote this letter.
I understand that. The problem is that when you have people like this who, and number one, they haven't been doing it that long. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I always say, I'm not surprised that I have almost no reviews in America that are even on the level of a first grader could give a better review than most of the reviews that I get, because the people don't have the experience and the background to write about my work, because my work is grounded in what I was doing in the 60s, you know. And I always say, if you want to look at the work of a what you call a 60s artist, then you have to look at their work in the 80s and 90s. You don't look at their work in the 60s. If somebody is a 28-year-old artist right now in 2009, you don't look at their work in 2009. You look at their work in 2029. So what did somebody who was coming into a consciousness of art, right? This arc of development, which doesn't exist. I mean, you know, I've been talking a lot over the past few years, really calling for a secessionist movement, like the one that was in the 1890s in Vienna, which was the birth of modern art, which was when the artists in Vienna in 1895-96 said to academia, we refuse to allow you to say what art is, and by the way, Linda, whatever the fuck your name is,
Burnham,
while art, you know, oh, there's like six different things I could say at once, I'm so pissed off, you know, the reality is that while academia is a reflection of the art world, it is not and never will be the art world. So anybody in that position, they are not artists, you know, they're not the people making the work, and that is not you know, it's like the people, like, you know, you pick up Vogue magazine. I mean, I haven't read it for a while, but I can tell you that if we went to a library or something and you took a Vogue magazine from July 07, it would be talking about wearing, boots, you know, even in the summertime. And it would tell you to be wearing gray. And that you should be, you know what I mean? It's fashion instead of style, you know. Someone like Frank and yourself, you know, you have developed your own vocabulary, your own language. You know, someone like this does not have the right at all to. Her letter is so stupid. It's so dumb. It's so sophomoric.
What? What in the fuck is the A art dialogue? What in the fuck is the art dialogue when she talks about that? Not concurrent with the current.
They're retarded. Honest to God. I mean, I'll tell you the truth. Like about almost 10 years ago, I started talking about appropriation. I used the word as a put down. Like, oh, they're appropriating this. They're appropriating that. Do you remember Reza Abdo?
Yes.
You know him?
Yeah.
Reza Abdo. I would go and see Reza Abdo's work when he came to New York, and his work made me furious because he was the opposite of me. He was all surface and all imagery, and there was no content. Like what he was doing didn't matter, and that was his work. And I think it's always important. It's a gift when you can see somebody who does what you when you see an artist whose work is in opposition to what you believe. And that's a very powerful, motivating force. You know, makes you really go, right? And it also brings out a lot in you. And Reza Abdo was that for me. And I would say all the time, oh, nobody appropriates more images than Reza Abdo except Madonna. You know, they're just like, oh, you know, like I go and I see a piece and oh my God, that's from Visconti's The Devils, and oh, there's the burning book, and like, you know, there's not one original image here, you know. And I would like, you know, so I've talked about appropriation for a long time as a put down, you know, like, oh, this is appropriated. Like, oh, I don't want to see one more. Oh, it's like the Worcester Group. It's like a junior high school version of the Worcester Group doing Richard Foreman. I can't cope, you know. And people would get very mad at me, you know. But I would say it. But the art world that I grew up in the 60s in New York, because there was no money involved, you know, the ability to talk about what you saw was a currency in itself, you know. And people didn't get mad at you when you could read something. And you'd say, bop, bop, bop. You know, and that was like, well, what are you going to do? Rocks are hard, water's wet, and bop, 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 you know. And then what happened was this academia took over. So after 100 years after the secessionist movement, academia took over again, you know. And this letter, I mean, look, all I know is this. I've been performing professionally since 1967. I'm going to be 59 years old. When I open up an envelope for my Social Security and it tells you how much you're going to get,
right.
Mine says I'm going to get $280 a month. So what does that mean? That means that for 40, whatever it is, 41 years, that not one not-for-profit venue that I worked in all of these years, not one of them ever threw a buck into my Social Security account.
Right.
Yet every single one of them have Social Security, health insurance, 401ks, paid vacations. And then they want to say to me or to another artist, oh, this is not really currently in the dialogue that we're having with art, you know, or, well, you know, we can't book you, you know, ever, you know. Well, you know, you know, what are you complaining about? You had your chance in the 80s, you know, whatever. Like, I did a festival last year in New York.
You? T A talk talk no T A talk to the S same people. You talk to the same people that we talk to,
right? Because they're the only ones that are there, and they're all mostly full of shit. And but the thing is that you see, artists need. See, this is the thing that's pathetic. Thing that is pathetic is that, like, you know, I always say to, like, younger artists, you know, there's nowhere to go. You're not going anywhere. You know, there is no there. There's no money. There's no career. It doesn't exist. Like, one of my things about emerging arts is that how dare these universities say to these students that, you know, that there's a profession called art when there is no profession. There's no profession, because if there was a profession, and I've been performing for 41 years, when I open up my Social Security, I'm not getting $260, right? Mm-hmm. And I've not only have I been involved in, like, you know, five or six of the biggest movements since 1967, but I'm an adept, right? And then people like to see my work. They want to pay to see my work. The public has always wanted to see my work. They have always been in the way of the public getting to see my work.
Yes.
You know, yes. It's all about access.
Yes.
They are gatekeepers.
Yes.
They are, they provide or do not provide the access.
Yes. Yes.
You know, so how are you going to have kids?
R-E-A-D, read, M-A, mainstream avant-garde. Mm-hmm. Get me pull out another piece.
Well, they're so retarded, too. Like, when people talk about avant-garde, they talk about, like, they use avant-garde as an adjective. Oh, your work is so avant-garde. What the fuck does that mean?
So this is a piece that Frank wrote in 1996.
Yeah.
I suppose this is a review of sorts. Two things evoke this review. First, Martha Wilson of Franklin Furnace asked me to comment on the Furnace's plans. The second event was our going to a Karen Finley reading, which cost $3 as opposed to $30 for a Finley performance, which I could not afford. I have to start by saying I consider both Wilson and Finley powerful voices of the avant-garde. When other performance galleries were making artists create, quote, acts that would fit into, quote, avant-garde cabarets, fit in terms of both time and fashionable subject matter, Wilson at the Furnace was giving both artists and the art absolute freedom to perform magic until they shut the Furnace down for, quote, fire violations. Karen and I were among the artists who enjoyed this freedom. In other reviews, I have likened Karen's poetry to Ginsberg's and her performances to Lenny Bruce's in their intensity and laser commentary on the social injustices. Her poetry makes me cry. Her passions within her performances have transported me into very deep states of reality. So it is always tragic to see figures like these get sucked, seduced, absorbed, tricked, bribed into the, quote, mainstream. It is tragic not only in personal terms for the individual artist, but in terms of the big picture. When an artist sets herself up as being an artist who goes beyond the normal frame, who tells the hard truths, who explores the unknown, not to be hip or controversial or to be interesting, but because that is how our tribal human being evolves, so it has to be done. When that kind of artist then goes after money, personal fame, and or glamour, while still claiming to be doing avant-garde art, it is denying society the real evolutionary function of the real avant-garde. It tells people, audiences and artists alike, that the avant-garde is just a branch of the entertainment complex with the same rules, goals, reality as television, rock music, Hollywood, and sports. This is like telling people a can of Slim Fast is a balanced meal of real food. It is a lie. And the scary, dangerous thing is artists are buying, selling this lie. Why am I on this rant? About a year or two ago, Wilson sent out a mass mailing in which she defended art, maybe to funders, as a profitable industry which pulls people, money, and jobs into cities. True, if you want to make a lot of money, buy property where artists live / create now to sell to the yuppies when they discover the area. This logic is a very steep, slippery slope indeed. The first glaring danger of this commercialized logic is art, according to this logic, which is not profitable or sellable, is not and cannot be successful, worthwhile art. Hey, ain't that the American way? I'm sure Wilson does not believe this. Although another mass mailing I received from her in November, I have been mulling it over until now, makes me wonder if she has fallen down that slope into believing the lie. Avant-garde art is art that tells the truth, explores the taboos, pushes the limits. Obviously, this kind of art, if it is honest, cannot be focused outwardly. Historically, often the people, who are not the same as the mainstream, have identified with the avant-garde because it was telling the truth about their lives. The focus of the avant-garde should always be on telling the truth, not on popularity polls and bottom lines. The focus of the avant-garde has been and should be on doing art that is as, quote, pure as possible, not on mass media entertainment of reaching as many people as possible by shaping the, quote, product to that goal. In her letter, Martha refers to the avant-garde art as, quote, once unpopular work formerly at the nonprofit fringe, quote, art that Franklin Furness, according to the letter, has groomed for 20 years to get it ready for the mainstream. And now, quote, Franklin Furness is in a position to lead the avant-garde into the mainstream, unquote. This hurts my head and my heart. It is as if Martha does not see her own historical contribution of giving daring art a home. Instead, she tries to take credit for gravity and decay. The mainstream entertainment, by its sheer mass, has always sucked artists out of the fringe, the underground. That is just gravity. In reality, it takes a lot to enter and to stay in the underground. The underground is where the real freedom and the real ability to change society are to be found. This is why artists choose the underground instead of the mainstream. This is also why, when an artist is pulled into the mainstream, this freedom and ability decay. In my own career, I have worked very hard to stay in the underground. This work has been hard precisely because some of the pieces have turned out to be, quote, popular, whatever that means, attracting the mainstream sharks. The mainstream has always tried to create a fake avant-garde with fake controversies, fake taboos, fake, quote, hipness, etc., to give the marks a controlled fun ride through a Disneyland to keep them away from the real edge of life. This is because the powers that be cannot control or exploit what is in the real avant-garde. All of this is business as usual and doesn't scare me. What does scare me is that someone like Martha bought into it and is becoming a producer of it. Her letter read like a bad Saturday Night Live skit. She is selling Franklin Furness to get money to match a $100,000 NEA challenge grant. With this money, and by teaming up with the corporate and media America, Franklin Furness will be a, quote, content provider for new media that sniffs out, quote, emerging alternative artists. Emerging from where to where? Alternative to what?
That's my line. Emerging from where to where?
These artists and their art must be suitable to be packaged as, quote, alternative comedy, a.k.a. performance art, unquote. The letter tells us this new alternative comedy will be, quote, funny yet provocative. There will be a half-hour TV show of this. Plus, they will produce short pieces to be aired through Saturday Night Live, as if that show has been cutting edge or even funny in the past 15 years. And MTV with its history of censorship. Moreover, they are seeking other ways of giving audiences a glimpse, in quotes, of the avant-garde world, whatever the hell that is, quote, in an entertaining and easily consumable fashion, unquote. Like avant-garde artist trading cards funded by Philip Morris companies. The marketing I did not make this up. The marketing phrase, quote, alternative comedy, a.k.a. performance art, unquote, is very damaging to performance art because it trivializes art. In fact, it avoids art altogether, selling alternative comedy as a weird, consumable form of entertainment which will give you a laugh for your buck. This is not what performance art is. Performance art is the performing slash doing slash experiencing the act of art. It is going on a physical journey into the unlimited realm of art. Sometimes this journey may be funny or entertaining, but these are not the true goals or rewards. The suggestion, promotion, that these are the rewards of art results in denying people, including the artist, the real, full, freeing experience of art. All of this is selling the art, the artist, and the audience way short. I am not questioning Martha's personal commitment to the real avant-garde art, but realistically, such art cannot exist in such an environment that she is envisioning. Moreover, it is misunderstanding the new media, such as the internet and zines. In this media, artists can relate to their audiences directly without middlemen, without compromises, without limiting concepts such as, quote, mainstream, all for very little money, so why sell out? but this concept of, quote, alternative comedy is disturbing. I guess the Karen Finley reading was an example of alternative comedy. She read from her parody of Martha Stewart, Why Bother, which she obviously wrote just to fulfill a book deal. The reading was empty shtick, a passionless exercise in cleverness with no content or message. The audience responded with reflex laughter like a laugh track. The problem was Karen was trying to be an entertainer, a comedian. Karen is not a comedian or entertainer. That is not her function. Her function is to inspire, confront, transmute, to tell the truth with passion. That is why people come to her. When she does not do that, the people are not fulfilled. When she ended her act, the people just sat there numb. Then I asked Karen to read her very deep, very moving poem, Black Sheep. I just happened to have a copy of it with me. As she read it, magic, life, and power started flowing through her body and out into the audience, uplifting them. When she finished reading, people stood up and clapped because this was why they came. Oh, by the way, do you consider yourself mainstream? Do you want to be?
What was that written in?
96.
Well, I mean, the thing is that, you know, like, I don't know if one of the nights, I don't know if you were there because I say different stuff different nights, but one of the nights I said, you know, any artist who thinks that they're successful because they're talented is deluded. You know, I mean, Karen got a tremendous amount of access, and Karen did a lot of good work. But all people stop developing at the point where they get the juice. That's reality. And the best thing that can happen to somebody is that they don't get any attention till they get over that desire for the approval. Not that it ever completely goes away, but when you have more loyalty to your work than you have to this other thing, you know? And I mean, let's face it, that whole fucking art scene is a popularity contest. They cannot handle, you know, they can't handle anybody original. They can't handle anybody with a point of view. They're terrified by, I mean, the thing
she
that...
She could, she should, no, could, always, she always was F.R. freaked out by four, no, B, because I was not going after fame. Yeah, it made her very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And she would want to she want to get Frank to explain it to her, but she, you know.
Yeah, but these people are pathetic. They're pathetic. It's and the thing is that I've been, you know, this is one of the things that I identified so much when I was reading the broadsides of the NYU lecture, because, you know, they hate me, you know, they hate me. And then they especially hated me because I did get to do my work in Europe, you know, where a few really intelligent reviewers could really write about the work. I have been completely dismissed, and my work has been completely scorned, and the fact that I created a lot of work was seen as a sign that, I mean, they always had something to say, either that I wasn't a real artist, or that I was, you know, they had a million things to say about me, you know. I've never gotten a grant, you know. I could never, I mean, even like in 1984, when I was 34, I couldn't get an emerging arts grant because they said I wasn't an emerging artist because I was a Warhol superstar. It's like I was 19 years old. I wasn't even doing my own work then. And then the NEA, people who worked for the NEA, told me for years that I needed to get to know the people. on the panels because they really thought that my work deserved to be funded, but the people on the panels had to know me. And I was like, what does that mean? You know, like, you know, what do you mean they have to know me? That's their job,
right,
to go out and see who the artists are, you know? And now in New York, I did my work for 20 years at PS122, always in a kind of opposition with Mark Russell.
He wouldn't book us, Mark Russell. He would send his, like, flunkies to see Frank perform at Franklin Furnace. But
he's too scared. He wouldn't
book us. And Frank talked to him for years, like, you know, kind of negotiating something.
Yeah.
E, X, C, E, except they, in, C. Oh, that was the kitchen. Oh, no, except in Cleveland. Yeah, the guy who booked for the Scott somebody, which I can't remember his name now. This was like in the 70s and 80s.
Scott at the kitchen.
Yes.
Yeah, he's the guy who said that my work had too much content.
Woo. Well, he selected Frank to perform at the Cleveland Performance Art Festival.
Right.
Yeah, but he's the one. I think we told you that. He said, I won't book him at the kitchen because I'm personally uncomfortable with his work, even though I think it's very important work, and it should be seen. So he booked him in Cleveland because he wasn't going to be there when Frank performed.
Yeah, but see, I mean, I did a festival last year in New York called the Globesity Festival. That money was given to me by a Australian venture capitalist who had used fasting to control an autoimmune illness that he had. And he wanted to do a film about fasting. And he wanted to have a B-roll for the film, which would have been, he gave me a certain amount of money where artists would fast for 10 days on juice, and then they would make a piece about overconsumption, right? And I had a panel called Who Is Not For Profit? The Artist Is Not For Profit. And I called, what's her name, from Franklin Furnace?
Martha? Yeah.
Put her on the panel. And I did all this shit on the emerging arts because she's one of the people who was an architect of the emerging art thing.
Right.
Her and Mark Russell, they were all over that, you know. Yeah. And now a lot of artists who are my age can't get booked in New York. I mean, Mark Russell does his Under the Radar Festival. You know, you can't get booked in it. You know, it's like... I have to send you a video of my show, New York Values, which is all about fragmentation, right? And the show just falls apart through the whole show. And it's a show about failure. And actually, I say to the audience, I said, you know, I ran into Karen Finley and I had a party and I told her I was doing a show about failure. And she said, "You're not a failure, Penny. You're not a failure. You're not a failure," you know, and, you know, and,
but I want to be, but I want to be.
Yeah, well, the thing is that there's something called, the Japanese have a concept, which is called the nobility of failure, that if your heart is in the right place, and your mind is in the right place, and you fail, it is more powerful than winning.
Yes. Yes.
But I wanted to say about the avant-garde, I mean, in New York Values, I say that Gertrude Stein addressed Oxford University in 1917, and she said, the avant-garde is in opposition to academia. As soon as academia accepts something, it is no longer avant-garde. You know, beginning, end of the story.
Yes. Yes.
You know, and right now what's happened is a lot of these people, you know, first of all, they're destroying the audience because the audience, see, Mark Russell wouldn't book you because he thinks that people are not going to come to see a person with cerebral palsy in a wheelchair. You know, he does not allow the audience. He will not allow that to happen. Like, okay, let's say only three people show up. He won't allow that to happen because he's concerned with his own failure, you know. I just think it's something quite remarkable that in the 60s that would never have happened. Do you know what I mean? There was, you know, an element.
Even when I P.A. packed Franklin Furnace. And Martha was telling him he should book Frank.
Yeah.
And she was telling him and Scott.
Yeah.
And they still wouldn't.
Well, I think people, I mean, look, there's a certain shock value, you know, that has always been in one corner of the performance art scene, you know. I mean, shock sells, you know. But besides that, I mean, I just have a tremendous resentment towards these people as gatekeepers. You know, the way Bitch Dyke Fag Hag Whore came about, you got to tell you this because you'll laugh. Mark Russell booked me in 1985 because Ethel Eichelberger saw me perform and called Mark up and said I was a genius and you have to book her. She's a genius before anybody else books her. So Mark, you know, Ethel apparently did like, you know, fantastic sales job on me. And Mark was all excited, you know, former Warhol superstar, blah, blah, blah. So I go there. He's offering me two weekends, which in 1985, this might as well have been a month or 2 months because it was a one-night stand, right? I go over and he starts asking me about the factory. He goes, you know, I don't know anything about the factory. You know, like, you know, what was it like being at the factory with Andy Warhol? And I said, it was boring.
And he's like, oh,
well,
T, I notice I... B, N, never asked you about that.
Yeah. So, you know, he's asking me. I told him it was boring, and then he started to get very defensive with me. Well, he started getting defensive. I started getting mad, you know. Then he took one of the weekends off the table, you know. So I went and did the performance, and it was four nights that were all improvised because all my original work was just improvisation. It was just performance. There was no, I would have like five ideas.
That's what Frank does.
And I would go on the stage with the ideas and make something from the ideas. So I put an ad in the paper, you know, quarter page ad. Because there were a lot of people who knew me as a performer when I was 17, 18, 19, 20, people don't usually forget the name Penny Arcade. I felt an obligation to have an audience. So we had like about 100 people every night, which was very unusual at that time. Like a full house would be like, you know, 40 people or something like that. And at the end of it, I said to Mark, I said, well, I'd like to do the show again in the fall. And he goes, well, you got to do a new show. And I said, but it was completely improvised. And he was like, yeah, you have to do a new show. Then I said to him, I said, well, did I get any press? And he said, press? He said, he goes, you didn't get any press. I said, why not? And he's like, he goes, people were very offended by your advertising. I was like, they're offended because I advertised? And he goes, yes, you know, and that was 85, then 86, 87, 88, never would book me. 89, there was like a big financial crash and the whole thing with the NEA started to happen. All of a sudden they weren't getting the money, there was no money. So then it was August, And he asked me to do August because Eric Bogosian was going on vacation. Because Eric Bogosian would do August to develop his work to do them in the bigger venues. I went and I did the show, also all improvised. And then, that was 89. Then 1990, I called him up. I said, hey, I said, I'd like to work on some new material. And he goes, oh, he goes, you know, we're completely booked up for 2 years. You know, I said, wow, I said, you're completely booked up for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And what happened was that in 86, Karen Finley had told me that there was going to be a big benefit, you know, at PS-122, they had them all the time. And that she had been talking to Mark, and Karen at that time was a big fan of mine, and she told me that Mark said I was on going to be on the benefit, you know. So I said, well, I didn't hear anything, so I called him up, and I said, well, Karen Finley told me that she's talking to you and that you were going to have me in the benefit. You know, there's 60 people in this benefit, 60. He goes, well, Penny, well, we discussed having you on the benefit, but we decided against it. And I said, decided against it? I said, there's 60 people performing. There's no room for me. And he goes, well, you know, we've done things with you in the past, you know. And I said, Mark, I said, I hope that you're saying a novena to St. Jude. That I'm never going to be successful because I'm going to fuck with you. And he got all freaked out because he's middle class. I'm working class. And to me, this is not a particularly big thing. I didn't understand that you can't say something like this to middle class people because they take offense. I was just trying to be direct. And I did not perform there again, you know, all those years. And then so in 89, he had me there because Annie Hamburger had booked me for her Avant-Garde Arts Festival. And she had come, I was performing in a venue called the Ballroom that was like a, like where people like Peggy Lee and people like that would perform, you know what I mean? And the guy was willing to have me there at 11 o'clock on Thursday nights because I would bring in an audience, you know. And Annie Hamburger came to see me there, and she's like, I don't understand why you're performing here. And I said, because nobody downtown will book me. And she goes, oh, you're just paranoid.
And they tell us that. Yeah. They always say we're paranoid.
I said, no, I said, the kitchen won't book me. That guy Scott, I ran after Mark wouldn't let me do the show again. I booked a place that was 100 seats above the 7A Cafe, and I ran 4 days a week for 4.5 months. And so I called the kitchen, and I say, hi, I'm Penny Arcade, and I want to invite you to see my work. And the guy says, well, actually, I was there last week. Weekend. I said, really? Silence. I go, I think by your silence must mean you didn't like my show. He goes, it's not my cup of tea. He goes, but you were packed. And I said, yeah. I said, luckily, you know, not everybody has the same taste as you, apparently. And then another guy who worked at the kitchen, I was in something that was at the kitchen, somebody else's work. And I was talking to the guy who was like, you know, one of the co-people there. And I said, I was in this show that was a total piece of shit. And I said, this is such a piece of shit. I said, but apparently has no problem getting booked here. And the guy says, yeah. And I said, well, you know, I called up Scott, you know, because I would like to be booked here. He went, Penny, don't bother. He goes, your work has too much content for the kitchen. And I was like, too much content? He He goes, yeah. He goes, way too much content. And I was like, okay, that's really fascinating. So then in 1990, I called Mark, and I said, you know, I've got some new stuff I'd like to work on. He goes, oh, you know, we're completely booked for 2 years. Like, 2 years? He goes, yeah. And I said, oh, that's too bad. I have a new show called Bitch, Dyke, Fag, Hag, Whore. It was completely made up. I just made it up in the moment. And he went, what? Oh. And I said, oh. Yeah, Bitch, Dyke, Fag, Hag, Whore. He goes, don't give it to anybody else.
Oh.
And that's the secret history of where that came from. Oh. But you know what I mean? The thing is, it's now I take it as a complete badge of honor because none of these people would really book me. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I kept PS-122 opened in 1992 mm-hmm. for the summer. They had no money to stay open. They had a 25th anniversary. They didn't even allow me. I was not. They wanted me to be on the committee, where they put your name on the committee. That, and I had spoken to Lucy Sexton, and I wrote her a very long email from Australia, and I said, look, it's imperative that I perform at this benefit for the 25th anniversary. I said, 20 years of work there. I said, I know that I created a substantial part of your audience base. And I said, I find it hard to believe that there's no place for me to perform or present or introduce, you know? And in the end, it turned out that what they wanted me to do was be on the committee, and that meant that I was supposed to sell like 5 tickets for $250 each.
Oh. You know?
And you know what I mean? It was humiliating, and then that was where I got off the bus. You know, I mean, it was very it's very interesting, but I think that, and I talk about this because I lecture at art schools at NYU, and I just tell the truth, you know. And the thing is that I will continue to make work because that's what I do. Mm-hmm. You will continue to make work because that is what you do. And all these people will fade away. Right. They will fade away. Right. And as Quentin Crisp said to me, not to worry, Miss Arcade, time is kind to the nonconformist. You know, and that's what you're up against. And Jack Smith, the great Jack Smith, said, let's see if I can do it. My voice is pretty rotten right now, but Jack said, the art world thinks that it loves art, but the art world hates art, and its only real response to real art is to destroy it. And the more tragedy that some person with a lot of essence has, the more they dangle that person in front of the public because it increases the vampire thrill.
Wow.
And that's a reality, and there's a reason why, you know, in Bohemia, you know, as a child, in sixth grade, a lot of the stories in my sixth grade reading book were by people who couldn't pay their rent 100 years before.
Right.
O. Henry, Edgar Allan Poe, Guy de Maupassant, you know, so, you know, in New York Values, which is an autopsy on the death of Bohemia, I question, you know, why is there always 100 years between, you know, the work of Bohemia and being able to earn a living, you know, and you will continue. You will, people who are looking for authenticity, you know, I met this girl from Toronto who's living there with the boys, you know. you know, Jack Smith said, you know, people pay a lot of money to go to art school, you know, and then they find out that they're not being taught iota by iota how to make art. And then they find out that they're going to have to become apprentices. Because that's the only way. You know, and I mean, I see people all the time. They've worked with me, shot video for me, whatever. And they work with me for a year or something. Then they come and they go, you know, all my friends think you're a genius. But, you know, nobody can figure out why you're not getting a deal. And I'm like, okay. And then they go and then they're going to do it.
We're running out of time for the show.
That's
so,
okay. It's
so we
good.
Have to wrap it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we definitely have to wrap it.
Yeah.
So shall we say?
We should say.
You are Penny Arcade.
I'm Penny Arcade all day long and all night long. This is Frank Moore, all day long, all night long.
On one of the B E, one of the best. One of the best.
Thanks, one of the best. Yeah, it's that we have so much in common, you know. And it's I found it very supportive and very like something that holds you up, you know, to read what you think, you know. And I hope that you find it also equally supportive. And,
yes.
And,
yes.
You know, to hold you up, to say, we're going to fucking survive.
Yes.
You know, because we have authenticity.
Yes.
You know, and
I,
that.
I have A F U N funny S story, but no, I have a funny story. A about G L about G the K I kitchen. Oh yeah. So what are we doing? Are we saying goodnight to the audience now? Okay.
Yeah.
Good night.
Night. Good night.
Okay. All right. So that's it, Mikey, on that.